on a more serious note, I was just saying to our whip, Honourable Kadebe, that if there isn't anything Free State aren't doing this year, and the latest thing, as you know, is hosting this great international literary festival with authors from, yes, and probably the most important, although I believe now with the great big hill that some outer space, one of these planets or stars or whatever sank in, next thing it'll be a huge scientific something. Never mind the political issues going on. So, but the Free State never surprises me. It indeed is a free state. So, I'll get a bit worried because I know our whip plays a very active role in the Free State. Thank you for being here on time. We've got just one or two comments on the agenda, but we are starting. And that is, before we have an exodus, here on the lines of Moses, we're going to have to get through our work. I don't know if that's a pertinent reminder of the exodus. Right. We're going to have a rolling tea break. The deliberations will immediately follow, and not afterwards, and there are very few announcements. Good morning. Now, what apologies do we have, Mr. Hermans?
Chairperson, we have apologies from Edward Albert and Mr. McIntosh. Both are due to party movements.
Right. Thank you very much. Right. I know someone was trying to reach me this morning. I just don't know who. Oh, yes, Honourable Hill Lewis. Self. Well, you know, I don't answer the voicemails because they're so difficult to hear. I'll have to tell people that after the joke. They must send an SMS, huh? Thank you. So, we have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda. Kadebe seconded by, yes, Honourable Wilma James. And may I say, we're hoping to finish at 12:30. So unless you've got something of significance to say, leave it for my SMS. Now, let's go straight into the formal consideration of the Cooperative Amendment Bill. And this, of course, is a serious matter. I think we're going to work with Mr. Hearns and, of course, yourselves. We are just going to go very quickly, but to comply with the legal requirements in this regard. Certainly we welcome the DTI, DDG's The Corridor, Chief Director Jeff Ndumo, Registrar of Co-ops Mr. Rafu, Ms. Kukumo, Director of Cooperative Policy, Legislation, Strategy, is that all? Right, and Advocate Jay Stradom. And then, of course, the constitutional and legal officers, parliamentary, I'm sure it's only one parliament, eh? Parliament, not parliamentary, legal advisor, advocate, Charmaine Van Merwe, Office of the Chief State Law Advisor, advocate, Alan Small, and Ms. A. Stoffel, secretary to Mr. Alan Small. Is that right? So all of you taken care of at the moment. The motion of desirability for Cooperative Amendment Bill, B17-2012. That in the opinion of the committee legislation, of the committee, legislation is desirable to amend the Cooperatives Act 2005. So as to provide for the substitution and addition of certain definitions, to provide for associate membership of cooperatives, to provide for categories of primary cooperatives, to provide for the national apex, to amend the accounting practices and requirements for cooperatives by providing for audit and independent review of cooperatives, to provide for the payment of fees by cooperatives for the amalgamation, division, conversion or transfer of cooperatives, to provide for the voluntary winding up of cooperatives by special resolution, to provide for the registrar to apply for a declaratory order in respect of the liquidation process, to provide for the cooperative tribunal to order the winding up of a cooperative, to substitute the advisory board with the advisory council, provide for the establishment, functions and powers of the cooperative's development agency, to provide for the funding and financial management of the agency, to provide for the oversight and executive authority of the agency, to provide for the establishment and composition and functions of the cooperative's tribunal, to ensure compliance with the principles of the intergovernmental relations, to provide the intergovernmental relations within the cooperative sector, and to provide for the substitution of the long title and the preamble, and to provide for matters connected therewith. Now that, of course, is the motion for desirability, which we, as part of the legal process that we're involved with now, we must begin with. Now, I have to put it to you formally, in a quorum. Do you agree with this? Can you propose adoption of this motion of desirability? I need it formally on record. Honourable Vandermiver?
I move that we adopt the decision.
Mover to adopt the motion of desirability. It is seconded by... And that is by the Honourable Yitlum Gorma, who has seconded it. Are we all in agreement? No objections. Right, now we're going to do this clause by clause by clause. Now, I really would like members to look at what CREDA has supplied us with, noting that it has gone through two or three reprints. So, here we are on clause one. Clause one. We move. Right. Clause one. Honourable Jitla Gorma. Honourable. Just shout your name through the mic.
My brother moves. You'll do seconds.
Right. Clause two.
I move.
Hello, Brenda Merva. Seconded by?
Fatih.
Honorable Khadiri. Second clause. Seven, clause three.
I propose adoption.
Honourable Will James, yes. Honourable.
I second. Babas.
It's been requested that we are very formal now with these things. So I do need your name into the mic, all right? Babas the second. Subs move, you know what I mean. Okay, let's move. Clause four, on page 8.
Hill Lewis moves.
Right, Hill Lewis.
Khatebe, seconds.
Thank you. Clause 5.
Mamasa moves.
Seconds. James seconds.
James seconds. My word, he moving. Clause 6.
Khatebe moves.
Khatebe moves.
Huang,
seconds. Right, thank you. Clause 7.
James moves.
James seconds. Right. Clause 8.
Babasa moves.
Seconds.
Khatebe
Mr. Melvin moves?
Lewis.
Mr. Melvin moves. Second.
Lewis.
Right. Clause 10.
Pat David moves.
Bang seconds.
James moves.
Pat David moves.
Clause 12.
Lewis moves.
Clause 53.
Wang moves.
Lose seconds.
Clause 54.
Mabasa moves.
Panamera seconds.
Clause 55.
Tomasa moves.
Hadeva seconds.
Clause 56.
James moves.
1 second.
Clause 57.
Loses.
Clause 58.
And a Mava moves.
12 seconds.
Clause 59.
Hadeva moves.
James second.
Clause 60.
Huang moves.
You lose seconds.
Clause 61.
Mava second.
Clause 62.
Tobaza moves.
Hadeva seconds.
Clause 63.
James moves.
Huang seconds.
Clause 64.
You lose moves.
That's a good thing we're applying our minds. Clause 64.
Mava moves.
Tobaza second.
Clause 65.
Hadeva moves.
James seconds.
Clause 66.
Huang moves.
You lose seconds.
Clause 67.
Mabasa moves. Panamera seconds. We're
seconds. 67. Now we're going. We're moving. Just a minute.
Yeah, that was a big one you managed to do.
Pardon the interruption, Madam Chair, if I may. The next clause is on page 42, right at the bottom.
At clause 67. Yeah. Am I, yeah, is Honourable Wilmot James is correct, I think. It's page 42, right at the bottom. But of course, what we're assuming, and we know, we don't have to assume, we know this, that you all applied your mind.
We have over 62.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Clause 67.
It's me.
Panamera moves. Tom has a second.
Clause 68.
Hadeva moves.
James seconds.
Clause 69.
Huang moves.
Lou seconds.
Clause 70.
Panamera
moves.
Clause 71.
Tom has
a moves.
Hadeva seconds.
Clause 72.
James moves.
Huang seconds.
Clause 73.
You lose.
Clause 74.
Panamera move.
12 seconds.
Clause 75.
Hadeva moves.
James second.
Clause 76.
Huang moves.
You lose seconds.
Clause 77.
Panamera six.
Clause 78.
Tobaza moves.
Hadeva seconds.
We actually found 78 on page 48. See how important this is.
Made a number of apologies during previous meetings. The process of proofreading has taken the better part of a week. We started last week, Thursday. Allow me to offer, hopefully, my last apology before we leave. there is a clause numbering mistake right at the end of the bill. On page 48, we've got clause 78 just above the middle. And then there's no clause 79, simply meaning that on page 53, we will, just before we request the final supply of the bill, just correct the numbering. On page 53, clause 80 should be 79, and clause 81 should be clause 80. We apologize for that.
As we are in the process of moving, but we need to move it. Can we move that, please?
Yes, I thought I wouldn't have my last chance. I move that we adopt clause 79.
And have that 80 amended, which is just a technical error. Is that right? Mm. So 79 to become 80 as an amendment. Am I right, Honourable?
Right. That clause 80 be changed to clause 79, and I move it as clause 79.
Thank you, Honourable James. Can we have another legislative expert with an honourable
and I second it as clause 79.
Right. Move to what is clause 81 on the printed document and have an amendment, Honourable Hill-Lewis.
Chair, I propose the amendment of clause 81 to become clause 80. The text stays the same, and I move that we adopt it as clause 80.
Seconded as amended. Honourable Member Hill Lewis.
Sir.
Mabasa is seconding the amendment as proposed by Honourable Member Hill Lewis.
Right, did you go to Kenya, Honourable Hill Lewis?
Yes.
Now I can see something odd happened on this Kenya. That's all over time. You all became one family suddenly. All right.
Honourable Chair, I yes. did not go on the Kenya trip, and I'm part of this one family.
Neither am I. I think we let others go on the trip to develop some social cohesion in the committee. But they went overboard, it seems. All right, members, back, of course, to the final process. No. Right. We're now moving to the report of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry on the Cooperatives Amendment Bill, B17-2012, and the Cooperative Second Amendment Bill, B18-2012, dated the 9th of November 2012. The Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, having considered the subject of the Cooperatives Amendment Bill, B17-2012, National Assembly, Section 75, and the Cooperatives Second Amendment Bill, B18-2012, refer to it and classified by the Joint Tagging Mechanism, JTM, as Section 75 bills, presents a redraft of the bills B17B, 20, 12. There's an error here. I'm the only one who has this error. Fine. 2012. The committee wishes to report further as follows. 1. On 25th May 2012, the Minister of Trade and Industry introduced the Cooperatives Amendment Bill, B17-25, National Assembly, proposed Section 75, and the Cooperative Second Amendment Bill, National Assembly, proposed Section 76. 2. The bills were referred to the JTM for classification in terms of Joint Rule 160. 3. According to the ATC dated 15th June 2012, the JTM in terms of Joint Rule 160 1986, clarified the bills as Section 75 bills. 4. Since both bills were classified as Section 75 bills by the JTM, and since both deal with the same subject matter, that is, amending the Cooperatives Act No. 14 of 2005, the committee agreed to consolidate the provisions of the Cooperatives Amendment Bill and the Cooperative Second Amendment Bill into one bill. 5. After deliberation, the committee decided to present a redraft of the bill to the House. The report to be considered. Now we need someone to propose a formal adoption of this. Honourable Mabar.
Comrade Chair, I move that the committee adopts the Cooperatives Amendment Bill B17B 2012. And it's Mabasa that moving.
Report and the bill. The report, okay?
Both the report and the bill.
Seconded by?
Small merchants.
Thank you. No, you know, look, after that, I'm sure if you're playing all those games that one sees at malls, you should be in top performance, judging from the way you got into the swing of these buttons this morning. But on a more serious note, I've said this before and I want to repeat it. I believe that this is one of the most important bills that will be taken to Parliament and I hope adopted by Parliament in due course. And that it is as significant as the Companies Bill, but from a different perspective. The Companies Bill, or Act Now, has really, really contributed to the transformation of South Africa in that area, but we needed something else as well. And I think that the committee has shown that it is not party parochial, that it definitely does put the people first. And I think that that is an important progress in our parliament, that we need to consider for whom we are developing legislation. Yes, we have our differences, and of course those differences remain important. But I, once again, Advocate Stratum, really, I think that you may have thought you've been apologising a lot, but the reality is the team has really produced solid work overall. This has been a very difficult process. I'll come to our parliamentary legal advisor, Advocate Charmaine Vandermeerwe, who is always and has been with us throughout her stay here, and you have truly, truly developed a redraft that we have found it easier to apply our minds to, and that has reflected the intentions of the committee. So we thank you for the solid work you've put in, and of course the contribution of the state legal advisor. And we know that the DTI itself, I'm sure, welcomes this recrafting of the legislation, and that we hope, you know, your intentions with the department, the ministry coming here, I believe have been enhanced and improved. So on that particular note, I really, Honourable Hadebe, I'm sure you would concur. We want to thank in particular the chairperson of the subcommittee, the Honourable Mabasa, Honourable Jitlangoma Mabasa, and his full team. I hope I don't get it wrong, but I think it was the Honourable Hill Lewis, the Honourable Huang, and the Honourable, was it Salal? Honourable Salal. I think that if you work on a subcommittee, it's like going, and doing basic training as a soldier. Boot camp, as they put it. There is no rest. And we really thank you for your commitment. Thank you very much. Honourable Hadebe.
Chairperson, a person will not agree with you more on the sentiments which you have just now. But really, I think that this portfolio committee has shown once again that South Africa comes first. South Africa comes first, and the welfare of the South African citizens is taken seriously by this committee, by the department, and all the stakeholders involved. So what is very important, Chairperson, is that on the day we are going to adopt this bill in Parliament, when we are going to pass it through Parliament, really, I think that the key stakeholders must be invited, and then we must have a press conference so that really we tell the South African public what this Parliament is doing, what these MPs are doing, as we did when we dealt with the issue of industrial policy action plan report in 2010. We must do the similar thing, and then also take a copy of this bill and send it to our Kenyan friends, Dr. Nyadishi and Dr. Wayema, so that we say they must just comment about what we have done and then come back to us. Because I think that we cannot afford not to be a learning portfolio committee. No, we have learning organizations, but this portfolio committee showed that it is a learning portfolio committee. I think that we must be proud of the work we have done. We just bounce it to them, give it to them, thank them that your input was invaluable. They can critique it however they want to critique it, and then give us some feedback. But the work done here was wonderful. Also, the team which went to Kenya, really, we were one big family there. I think even those Kenyans, they actually were surprised that can the politicians behave the way they behave, as the South African did, that you are just one person. But really, I think that the spirit of Ubuntu, we're able to export it to Kenya, and they really appreciated that, and that confirmed that. That's why I say that we must take this bill, send them, take it back to them, send them that's the product we've learned from you. Chairperson, thanks a lot again for your leadership and all the commitment of the committee. Chair, go to strategy now. Thank you.
James?
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to make two comments. The first is that there is a concept in genetics called repeat sequences. And looking at the voting process here, after exercising our minds, that was an excellent example of repeat sequences. My second comment is that your role as chair has been less that of a headmistress and more that of a musical conductor. And I'd like to thank you very much for that.
Thank you. But thank you to all of us. Thank you very much to the full house here this morning, as it were, the full group. Thank you. We are just releasing our whip to go to strategy and continue the fight on with ensuring our programming is not left to the graveyard shift again. So we are sending you into battle, Honourable David. Okay. It is supposed to be on the 22nd, and I raised the Kenyan report with the rule, with the programming whip, to say exactly where is this? Have you sent it back to Kenya or what? Because I've not seen it come through the house. And so that, please raise that again. It's not through, and they will be requiring the date. Yes. So the ATC. But you promised to give the ATC date. When was that? For the Kenyan? When? All right. But it definitely went through, I think, the first week of September, and it's not been through the house. All right. Thank you very much there. Look, on that particular note, while we always like having everyone here, as you know, but nevertheless, thank you for your role here, your contribution. You are released if you wish to be those who came here specifically for the cooperative amendment bills. And thank you for your cooperation. Right. We move very quickly. Very comfortable, and then the orchestra's over now, so now we move to the next thing. Yeah, but I don't know where the hell it's going again. Where's the number? Because minutes are not here as we talk, I'm going to welcome DDG Garth Strachan to address us. So as soon as we get the minutes, we will move into them. Now, Mr. Strachan, you saw how we went through that, so you can take out your little conducting tool and move.
Beg your pardon. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members.
just introduce the team. Catherine Matiza on my right is from the Chief Directorate Industrial Procurement, and Tapiwa Samanga behind Catherine is from our Metals, Fabrication, Transport and Capital Equipment Chief Directorate. We said in the first of the three presentations which we've made to the Portfolio Committee that ICPAP has firstly made measurable incremental gains, and I hope that was demonstrated in the various presentations on autos and clothing and textiles, as well as the general presentation which we made. And we've also suggested that this incremental scaling up of the IPAP in successive iterations has, for the first time, created what we would refer to as new platforms for industrial development and industrial policy, and those include industrial financing, trade measures, customs, competition, and so on and so forth. And one of those new platforms is procurement. It's a very new one. The amendments to the PPPFA were only finally promulgated in December 2011, but the instructions notes from the National Treasury further delayed the process, and I think the instruction notes went out somewhere in mid-year. And as members of the, or as the committee would have heard in the presentations, in perhaps in the public domain, there's also perhaps some misunderstandings about the process. And as you heard, one industry association in autos called for designation of autos, and another one from exactly the same industry called for us not to designate. And so I think we welcome the opportunity, and that's one of the issues that we will deal with. That's simply what we'll deal with today and the various headings for the presentation. Just by way of background, and we have presented some of this in the past, Madam Chair, I think the economic challenges that the country faces, just in summary, that would outline in graphic form the fact that our manufacturing exports are going south pretty steadily, and that our manufacturing imports are going north pretty steadily. And we've spoken about the fact that as the IPAP sets out, this is very often credit-fueled, consumption-driven, import-rich, very often household consumption, which has a huge impact on the balance of payments. That's manufacturing value add, which is also going south pretty steadily and perhaps a matter of considerable concern. This is the trade deficit. Agriculture and mining above the line by and large, and the manufacturing, which is green, as I've said, going steadily south. So, Madam Chair, the rationale for the designation of industry sectors, subsectors for local production or local procurement, that should be, is set out in the new growth path and the industrial policy action plan, with the need to identify and leverage public procurement, since there has been massive leakage from the economy with respect to large-scale, very often fleet procurement undertaken by the public sector. Of course, that also applies to private sector, and I'll deal with that a little bit later. Many sectors which are targeted in the IPAP will depend on leveraging public expenditure if they are to avoid deindustrialization and grow into the future. And public procurement includes three policy instruments. The first one of those is designation. That work has to be done by the DTI and the National Treasury, and I'll set that out shortly. The Customized Sector Development Program, which falls under the Department of Public Enterprises, and is that policy framework applied by Eskom, Transnet, and other state-owned companies in their large fleet procurement programs. And before the Cabinet is a new National Industrial Participation Program. The old NIF was essentially, from the perspective of the DTI, what governed the offsets, including the defense industry offsets for procurement above $10 million, and we can't, obviously this is, has to be dealt with at the level of the executive. The executive will presumably in the near future make announcements on the strengthened NIPP. We think that we need to make the point that public procurement is a strategic instrument widely deployed by developed and developing countries alike, and that the main objectives are to enhance and smooth certainty of demand over the years, to promote competitive and strategic industrial capabilities with high employment and growth multipliers, to diversify the economy towards more employment-intensive and value-adding activities, and to ensure value for money for the fiscus and society. And perhaps just to add the fact that enhancing and smoothing out certainty of demand, especially for large fleet procurement, gives certainty to domestic and, for that matter, foreign-owned companies. The certainty of demand is, and which includes increased aggregate demand in the economy, gives certainty, which should be seen not as a factor detrimental to foreign direct investment, but actually supporting foreign direct investment. So we've seen this in the green industries where there is considerable interest given the localization commitments for the renewable energy generation, where investors see the increase and long-term demand, can ramp up or bring in new investment into the country in order to meet that domestic demand, in so doing increase competitiveness as well as create the kind of capacity and the economies of scale which would be required to export from South Africa, and perhaps the green industries is a good example because we see increased capacity in green industries in relation to export opportunities in the sub-Saharan African region. Now, ma'am, the designation of sectors is informed by in-depth research analysis on both the demand and the supply side. They're critical variables, and this is very important because one of the problem areas could be what is referred to as so-called capture. In other words, a cozy relationship between public servants making the decisions around designation with companies producing these products, and so an independent, rigorous process is absolutely essential. And amongst others, that research looks into the issue of the magnitude of public sector demand for the product, reflected by government expenditure data, which is obtained from the National Treasury. And to, at the risk of stating the obvious, it wouldn't be much point in designating something for local procurement if the magnitude of government procurement was so small that it wouldn't have an impact on the manufacturing sector. Then there's the necessity to understand the local industry's capacity and capabilities, capacity in the sense of how much they can produce, capabilities in the sense of issues of competitiveness, standards, and so on and so forth. And this would refer to current but future projected capabilities as a set of instruments, including the Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program, are deployed to enhance capabilities in key sectors of the economy. And then thirdly, the value chain analysis, because this is very important, especially for products such as the set-top boxes, where there isn't capacity to produce some of the high-end knowledge or technology in terms of products or components in a particular product. And so it's very important for that value chain analysis to take place. And then engagements with key procuring entities to inter alia understand their procurement plans and local content achieved on in previous similar contracts. And then engagements with the OEMs and the local industry on firm co-commitments. And I'll speak to this in a little more detail shortly. I think what's extremely important is that we don't send a moral hazard signal to local companies that you will get government tenders regardless of your standards, the quality of your production, the competitiveness, and so on and so forth. And therefore, the right to undesignate any products lies with the Minister of Trade and Industry. And part of this process includes an examination of supply capacity and local content determination at product level. And we have to say that this is not an easy process by any stretch of the imagination, because some of these products contain a very wide variety of components, some of which are made here, others of which are imported, as I've already said. Now, the methodology for designation, which is on a very complicated template, and on average this template probably takes somewhere in the region of 6 months for a research team to do this work. We look at security of supply, and the supply is particularly importantly to, for example, pharmaceuticals. If we were to designate pharmaceuticals for 100% and then the hospitals ran out of a particular product, then that would, at the risk of stating the obvious, be a very dangerous precedent for the economy and for other sectors such as health. The significance of the sector, subsector or industry, so somebody once joked the other day that we would be unlikely to designate, for example, pencils, because you would be hard-pressed to stop deindustrialization if you designated pencils, which is precisely why we've gone for the big ticket, heavy industrial value-added fleet procurement for Eskom, for Transnet, and so on and so forth. In the designation methodology, we have to look very closely at government expenditure and the department entities that are involved in the procurement, and this is very time-consuming. We have to look at the industry structure and the level of competition, so we would be highly unlikely to designate a sector where there is a monopoly or a near monopoly and where there is import parity pricing which is being practiced in any particular sector. The level of employment in the sector, and this involves the collection of complicated data not only from the national accounts but the bargaining councils and so on and so forth. The export-import trends, so this requires that we work very closely with SARS and customs to look at big spikes of, for example, of imports, which suggest or could possibly suggest a whole number of things, which are important. A, that a particular sector is under threat from a massive surge of imports. Of course, it could suggest a whole lot of other things as well, potentially suggest dumping or illegal imports. So the monitoring of import and export trends is very important. And then there are various modalities which we apply closely with the National Treasury. That would include price benchmarking, which we've had assistance not only from the National Treasury, but the United Nations Industrial Development Organization. So global price benchmarking and reference pricing becomes very important so that in any particular tender, it becomes very important to ensure that if you've designated for local procurement, that local companies aren't adding huge premiums over and above the global price. By the way, as a matter of interest, the Brazilian local procurement applies a 20% premium for local procurement in the Mercosul region. We are applying no local premiums at all, and it's a matter of interest, for example, that there is a company in Cape Town that is manufacturing very globally competitive boats. These are shore-to-ship, shore-to-oil rig boats with defense and policing capabilities, and the Brazilian local procurement regulations were so onerous that in order to win the tender, they have to consider setting up a local production facility for part of their components in Brazil. So I'm giving that as an example so that, you know, if there is a sense that somehow or other we are a kind of outlier in respect to this policy instrument, which we certainly not. And then, Madam Chair, the issue of deeming of certain primary intermediate inputs is very important. And so because we have a near monopoly in the production of steel in South Africa, and we have a practicing of import parity pricing, which notwithstanding the fact that we, as members know, have got this huge reserve and production of iron ore, our reductants are cheap, and our labor in this instance and our transport costs are not significant. Nevertheless, that the company concerned practices import parity pricing, and therefore we deem steel as local, and the same would apply, for example, to plastics and polymers. And so that becomes very important as an instrument to send a signal that where there's a monopoly which is undertaking import parity pricing, we would not apply this particular instrument. And what becomes also very important in a complicated process with the National Treasury is that procurement, wherever possible, should be directly from manufacturers. I'm very happy that the DDG responsible for Black Economic Empowerment, Mr. Sekodi, stayed here, because one of the things that does become important is where there's import fronting, where intermediaries import things, and where there's BEE considerations which are applied, but actually we might be creating jobs in India. And so the dual policy objectives of Black economic empowerment and local procurement need to interact with each other to ensure that import fronting is something which we take a very strong and active position against. Now, ma'am, just to very quickly, and I'm mindful of time considerations, just to outline the procurement process, and Catherine is going to help me here where I make any mistakes. It's a complicated process. writ invitations and the conditions of contract, specify the local content requirements in the bid documents, which are set out by the National Treasury, the local content declaration, and that's the technical specification for it, must form part of the bid, the bid evaluation and award, which is the National Treasury, is a two-stage evaluation process. The first stage is local content and functionality, and the second stage is BBBE and price. Disqualification happens immediately if the local content declaration is not submitted or the threshold is not met for designated products. Clause 9.3, I think it is, Catherine, allows all state entities outside of designated products to stipulate local content requirements. And that's an area going forward, and I'll speak to this very shortly, where we think there's considerable room for improvement and possibly, and I say possibly because we are in the process of gathering this kind of information where there might be some more room for abuse with respect to import fronting. And it's the verification and record keeping. Random checks are conducted, and that falls under the DDI and the National Treasury. And the records of supporting documents will be kept for 5 years. Madam Chair, just to quickly run through that, the documents, the technical specification, which is a SABS specification, that's the technical number for it. That's on the measurement and verification of local content. The repository for that, as I said, is SABS. The DTI is responsible for the guidelines on the measurement and verification of local content and the templates and annexes on the calculation of local content, which is the research. And those templates are, that research is conducted by Catherine's chief directorate, and there is a very rigorous and clearly defined process, which includes a designation advisory board, which is chaired by Tebogo Makube, the chief director, who couldn't be here today because he's on an investment promotion mission to South Korea. Once that is formally signed off, it goes to the minister, and from the Minister of Trade and Industry to the Minister of the National Minister of Finance. And the standard bidding documents and the instruction notes for each designated sector are issued by the National Treasury to all state entities. So far we've designated, as the committee knows, and that just sets it out with the minimum thresholds for local content, which in some cases is 100%, and at the risk of stating the obvious, that's where we've got 100% capacity to meet state procurement demands. Progress, very briefly, because we have mentioned this, PRASA announced a passenger coach renewal, which is over 7,000 coaches over 20 years, and the RFP at the moment includes a 65% local content. That doesn't suggest that going forward it can be ramped up as supply and development allows for greater capacity and higher up the value chain. Then the Transnet Fleet Renewal Program, that RFP has been issued, and it's a $300 billion capital investment. It is said that outside of the People's Republic of China, it's the second biggest freight rail procurement in the world. And the RFP there includes 65% local content requirement. With respect to pharmaceuticals, 73% was achieved in the oral solid dosage tender. The antiretroviral tender has been issued and preference will be given to local manufacturers. My understanding, and Catherine will correct me if I'm wrong, that there are ongoing negotiations with the National Treasury in relation to the final threshold there. And obviously, issues of security of supply become very important. The bus bodies, we've worked closely with the city of Cape Town, Johannesburg and Tshwane to put together the local content requirements for the procurement of buses, in order to try and get beyond the designated threshold. And one of the constraints in this particular area, in fact, is an industrial financing constraint. So, ironically, the Brazilian National Development Bank can give better industrial concessionary financing to Marco Polo, the Brazilian bus producer, from whom many of our metros have already bought, than our own domestic industrial financing can provide for local companies. And as I've mentioned before, it's one of the issues that we have to address in the next IPAP. Our export financing can provide good concessional financing for companies bidding for tenders in wherever, Ghana or Dubai, but perhaps somewhat ironically, they're unable to provide the same concessional financing for domestic production. So there is a financing supply side constraint. The set-top boxes, this has been a complicated process involving the Department of Communications, and a 30% local procurement threshold was identified in the tender. Madam Chair, in the interest of time, the conditionalities, the preferred bidders, such as the original equipment manufacturers, we require them to give long-term contracts to local suppliers. Secondly, that local industry must commit to making the necessary investments towards modern manufacturing techniques and industry upgrading. And as I said, this includes the deployment of other industrial policy measures so that the Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program can be deployed to assist local industry to scale up as we set conditionalities for them in relation to local procurement. So it's no point, for example, and this is simply a theoretical example, that the suppliers of local transformers are uncompetitive globally, but we're supporting them through local procurement, but no effort is being made for them to be more competitive with better capital equipment, better systems, better management, greater productivity to lower price, improved quality, and scale up capacity in terms of the quantum of the production. Local industry should commit to job retention and the creation of new job opportunities. OEMs should commit to skills and technology transfers to local manufacturers, and industry should be price competitive. I've already stated that there is no premium added. That industry should commit and gear itself towards international competitiveness. I've dealt with that, I beg your pardon, and government retains the right to undesignate. Other areas outside of designation, the CSDP and new NIP include the procurement accord, government, business and labour commitments to local procurement are contained under that. Madam Chair, that work is led by EDD, but we are working closely with EDD, and I think that progress has been disappointing with respect to commitments given by the private sector. We have met, for example, the Chamber of Mines. In terms of WTO regulations, we cannot legislate or regulate with respect to private sector commitment. But if, for example, big industry associations like the Chamber of Mines get their members to commit to local procurement with strong conditionalities, including those that I've set out, that would obviously be a great fillip. So, you know, there's many examples. If our private sector hospitals were to commit to, subject to all the conditionalities, to procuring syringes and medical supplies from local procurers and so on and so forth, this would be very important. for non-designated sectors and procurement hauling outside of the CSDP, and I beg your pardon, Madam Chair, that should read, and, I'm correct, non-designated sectors and procurement falling out of the CSDP, in other words, falling out of supply development, as contained in 9.3 of the regulations of the PPPFA, that applies especially to provincial government and metros. That works led by EVD, and we think that it's an area where there's room for massive improvement. It's very difficult to get very accurate data on how much actually is being procured locally by provinces and metros. And then, Madam Chair, many other countries have massive national by local campaigns. The committee knows that proudly South Africa went through a difficult period. We have been working very closely with proudly South Africa, the manufacturing circle, and the economic departments, and a revitalized national by local campaign will be launched at an executive level shortly. And that speaks to the necessity to change sentiment nationally with respect to the importance of buying local. Where are the areas of further work which are required when we look at the way going forward? That would speak to the national coordination, intergovernmental matters of large infrastructure and strategic government expenditure, and that would apply very concretely to the massive infrastructure program under the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Committee, and we are meeting with those that committee in order to ensure that there is alignment of large infrastructure expenditure with localization regulation and programs. And a multi-departmental monitoring and evaluation of the impact of all the procurement instruments is required, and we are working on that. Much greater coordination of strategic procurement and greater participation by departments in transversal contracts. And that is complicated, and there are important legal considerations. So turnkey projects, for example, big housing projects, which are given to contractors where there are important local components. So for housing, you'd be speaking about solar water heaters, but piping, electricity, transformers, switching gear, and so on and so forth. And it's with respect to turnkey projects where the private sector is responsible for delivering the package of the tender, there are complicated legal issues which we are working on going forward. And then, Madam Chair, there needs to be improvement in the depth of procurement data and analysis systems. And so I can say with confidence that we've only designated those products which we consider strategic for the reasons that I've set out previously, and we won't designate where there's any doubt. So, for example, to hook up to Wednesday's discussion, we have no intention at the moment of designating motor vehicles because we cannot arrive at a clear determination that that's in the interests of the national economy. We are ready to go with respect to solar water heaters, electrical and telecom cables, and school and office furniture. Hasn't yet been signed off by the minister, and so obviously when I say ready to go, it's subject to the minister applying his mind to those matters, and work is happening with respect to transformers, valves, pipe, other rail infrastructure, signalling, green industries and components of renewable energy generation build program, where you have important complications because if in any particular tender we don't specify products higher up the value chain, you can potentially have a problem where designation is the concrete for the wind generator and the fence around the wind generator. But we have to move to a situation where higher up the value chain, the designation includes the components high up the value chain. And I've already mentioned construction materials in the turnkey project. Madam Chair, in the interest of time, leave it there.
We will be asking questions and making comments. But what I would like to ask you, Mr. Strachan, is if you would just enable us and cooperate for us just to go through two sets of minutes, please. Right, so we will come back. Members, if you turn to the 11th of October, they're not as big as they look, it's just that you've got the hand part, you know, attached to them. Is everyone there? 11th of October. Can someone just check where Honourable Babasa is? Right, page 1, page 2, page 3. Well, sorry, the attendance register, the list, just ensure that it's all signed as it should be. Right. And I want to propose adoption, who is present. The Honourable Madam Irva, second. Honourable Mabasa. The 17th of October. Thursday. And that is page 1. Just looking to see who's present here. Yeah. Page 2. You remember that we've just finished with the co-op's bill, of course. Page 3, page 4, page 5, and of course the last page there, the attendance list, that is the minutes of the 17th of October. Can we have someone to propose adoption?
I do.
Honourable James, seconded by Honourable van der Merwe. Two, I thought we had three, but you know, I know that there was a request for someone to move off to another meeting, and that's why we took these minutes right now. Do you? Yes, we've done those, haven't we? I can quickly do the 9th, which will take a minute. Where are they? Does someone give me one? Right, page 1, the 9th of October. Had almost a full house there. Page 2. Page 3. The definition of surplus is there, of course, as well. Page 4. Well, actually, it should be page 4 in one sense, in that it included the subcommittee report on co-ops, which is almost an annexure. I'm sure you appreciate that, and then the list. Someone to propose adoption, Honourable Kubasa, that's hand, thank you. Seconded by Honourable Wilmot James. Right, those are, we're more or less up to date in the minutes. You'll do a few more next week, which will bring us right up to date. Just for those who are leaving now, just a reminder, the next committee meeting will be next week, I think it is on Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken, on the 14th. And on the 14th, it's a very important one, Department of Public Enterprises, the SA Maritime Authority, and of course, further engagement with Eskom and NERSA. If there is anything that you feel you wanted to ask, you didn't ask, and you wanted in writing or for them to respond to, please email Mr. Hermans. That is very important, because we've got clothes off. We are clothing off IPAP, incidentally, on the 21st of November. So thank you very much to everyone then. And then we move back to the questions and comments. May I add, this is a very important process, the industrial procurement and designation of sectors, because really we begin to get to grips with the local manufacturing and industrialization. But I think there are a number of pertinent questions and comments that are going to arise, and the linkage as well, as you try to emphasize, between the triple B double E coming up as well, in view of what we've already heard in IPAP, etc. But over to our members on my left. Honourable Mabas.
Thank you very much, Chair, and the presentation was very thorough and indeed informative from the department. I think it's all moving in the right direction. I mean, one certainly had a feel that this is a very vital part of stimulating manufacturing and indeed growth in our society. But it strikes me that as you push up, and the graph goes like north, as you described it, for local procurement, so the manufacturers are going down. So the big question is the capacity going to be there to supply these things? Although you have underscored that this is an important aspect of the supply of the supplying to government of these key areas of work, it doesn't look like it's happening. I mean, we've heard in the last week so many companies come and tell us, and so many sectors come and tell us how they're closing down. And I mean, the one obvious one from the other day was that the apparel manufacturers have said, well, they can't get textile supplies, and yet that is 100% designated for 100% local content in one of your slides. I think that points to slide 16, which is probably the most important slide, which really talks about the coordination and the linkages at different levels of government, including the CSDP, which I'm assuming is the Competitive Supplier Development Program, am I right? From public enterprises. Okay. So are these things working together? Are we going to be able to allow the businesses that are complaining that the electricity price, for example, has put them out of business? Are we going to be able to get it right so that the manufacturing goes up at the same slope as the opportunities for procuring locally? I, at the moment, can't see that those two lines are moving together. Thanks.
Honourable Van der Merwe, Honourable Mabasa.
Thank you very much, Colleague Chair. I also, following on the appreciation expressed by Colleague Van der Merwe, that this is a very important input, really. I think we do wish to say thanks to the department. But I am also on the graphs, on the graph on 3. If Mr. Stachem could just repeat the explanation there, because when I look at that gap between, when I look at 2010 and I look at the gap between the red or and the blue, that space being so wide, just to further interpret it, because I wouldn't have thought that it should be so bad. And also, that goes hand in hand with on 4, that sharp slope. Couldn't it be relatively flatter, so sharp? Because I understand that the sharpness means negativity for us. It's not a positive for us. So if Mr. Chaplin could also speak to it briefly, maybe I'm misunderstanding. And then on 15, I just missed, it could have been explained somewhere, the full wording of CSDP. And then, the one but last point, Comrade Chair, is that I think we have a challenge of engaging with training institutions to so that when we speak of the critical role of buying local, it is done from all fronts. Because if I recall some years back, by South Africa was discouraged, I mean by economists. Economists were saying, once you speak that language, it's wrong economically, you can't speak that language. So the same institutions also have to change tune. Otherwise, we will produce students who may not necessarily be aligned to the real world. Because indeed, countries like Brazil, they unashamedly speak proudly about buying Brazil. And then the last point is the coordination. It relates slightly to what Comrade Van Emmerbe spoke of. That if we don't accurately manage demand and supply in a forecasting manner, we will do badly. In the sense that especially government bodies, huge procurers, they should plan ahead and communicate those plans ahead to say, in a year's time we are going to need steel, and we are going to need steel of these measurements, so that they move in unison with the suppliers, because the suppliers will also say they cannot produce and not be guaranteed that there will be a purchase. And at the same time, we as government, if planning is poor, we will simply want to buy what's available. So I think that's incorrect. And I think a team needs to be created to work particularly on that so that we grow in that area. Thanks, Comrade Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mabaza. Honourable Huang, followed by Honourable Kwabasa, sorry, before Honourable Huang.
Chair, two quick questions. On slide 11, on designated sectors, I see automotive industry is not part of that. Is there any particular reason why it is not there? Or is it because it is already achieving those kinds of thresholds? Secondly, on Transnet, there was a report just about 2 or 3 weeks ago in the media, Business Day in particular, that Transnet was giving a tender to a Chinese company to build locomotives. I wanted to understand whether is that tender an investment into the country and therefore local production and local content, or what does it mean? I couldn't interpret it in the manner it was reported. Thank you. But it sounded to me a bit contrary to what we're trying to do under the industrial policy action plan.
Thank you, Honourable Mkwabasa. Honourable Huang.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. I think mine is more a generalization, not specific to any slide, but what normally happens is for local content and local procurement, I fully stand for that. that people don't actually take a look is the prices of it. The prices of it is higher than when you import from China. That's one of the major concerns. That's why you can see such a large gap. Now, one of it is efficiency of productivity. I think that's one of the things. Are there any plans to develop that to maybe train the manufacturing sector for the efficiency? So I know I've been to China. I originally come from Taiwan. Taiwan, back in the day, basically everything was made in Taiwan. Everything was made in Taiwan. But then after China, because of the cheaper labor and efficiency, all the factories moved over to China. So now everything is basically made in China. And that's the same problem worldwide. It's when you go to China and actually take a look at the factories, the people are constantly there, constantly monitored, and they got paid according to what is produced, the products produced per shift, for example. And they actually work, a lot of the companies work 24 hours a day. So they've got three shifts of laborers which constantly work, which shows efficiency, which obviously brings down costs. Are there any plans to educate or to basically train our South African market to actually get their productivity much higher and their efficiency higher? I think that's one of the big causes. With local content being cheaper, then obviously more people will be more people will support it. At the end of the day, if I'm a private business, I take a look, I can buy local content of example pens or anything. I can buy the locally made pens for R5, or I can buy them from China for R3. There's a savings there. Obviously I would want to support local content, but at the end of the day it's looking at the price factor, and that's the main issue. Now we're competing against China. They've got a vast population, but with the population is productivity and efficiency. What are we doing basically to go and take a look at improving that in South Africa? Once the prices get lower, then that will result into higher purchases. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Huang. Yes, I'm very pleased the Honourable Mabasa is requested further explanations on these graphs that you've got. I must say, at first sight, they're quite alarming. I mean, the kind of thing I would have asked, you know, the one on slide 3, what were they doing in 2002 on manufacturing exports that they could get up to there, and what are they doing now? Yeah. They're getting a lot more support now, I thought. So where are we going wrong? Or, you know, where did we go right? Now where are we changing and things are moving differently? Again, adding on to the questions already raised, but looking at the, the next slide 4, one is looking again at the value add. Now, I'm not sure if I'm reading the graph correctly, because, you see, We're not promoting value add. We've got everything going for value adding and beneficiation. You never said it so much in 2002. Of speaking too much and doing too little. I mean, because the talk is loud now, but I don't, you know, the information does reflect that. And I could go on and on onto these graphs. Now, this is alarming. And we want a clarification on this, because then we'd better stop talking and go out ourselves and manufacture. But the issue of the Brazilian local procurement manufacturing and the premiums here. You spoke about the local content, etc. Could you just explain that again, and then you put in the Brazilian, well, look, they don't do that, or they do this, and the Mercosur, etc. Now, we're trying to promote local content. What is the most effective way that countries who were where we were, at what stage we were in advance of Brazil? Now, you've been trying to spell out what the Brazilians, one or two areas they've done differently. Now, I don't recall them being a pariah now because they've done that. So what makes us a pariah if we do it? I just don't understand that. Perhaps you can unpack the dynamics behind that particular one. And it always interested me, the OEMs, it's original equipment manufacturers. The word original has got so many meanings. I'm not sure, again, what original means in this respect. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Catherine and Tapiwa will come in and support me. Those are incredibly difficult questions from members. If they are alarmed, I think we would share that alarm. As we've been saying repeatedly, we are facing the threat of deindustrialization. And it's not something that we can be complacent about. As we've said, we are facing multiple shocks, and the global financial crisis and economic recession is this huge external shock which has added to the problem. And then there are a range of domestic shocks which we've spoken about, and those include administered prices, food charges, electricity charges, and so on and so forth. So the first question, the first point that I'd wish to make in response to questions which are sometimes politically loaded, and I'm trying to stick to technical questions and answers, is that the response of the IPAP essentially takes effect in 2007. So you have the National Industrial Policy Framework, I think in 2007, and successive iterations of IPAP. So that more or less coincides exactly with the onset of this huge global recession and a set of domestic shocks. The deployment of a set of industrial policy measures coincides exactly, and I'm getting onto tricky political terrain here. Comes after the deployment of industrial policy interventions that are immediately put in place by other countries such as Brazil. So that's the first part of the problem. The second part of the problem is the quantum that you deploy and how quickly you deploy it. I think we did very well in certain respects. The fact that the distressed fund of the IDC was deployed almost immediately, in fact, before Brazil deployed a distressed fund, in my understanding, but other instruments lag. And so you get into complex terrain about economic theory and economic strategy and state-led interventions as opposed to free market interventions, and the politicians in the room, the honourable members would be better placed to engage at a political level with those problems. We carried out the instructions. So to try and answer the questions, the situation is alarming. There is declining manufacturing exports. There is declining manufacturing value add. We're facing stiff competition globally, as the Honourable Huang says, from the emerging or emerged tigers, including China. The global economy is characterized by swathes of incentives and subsidies and distortions in the markets, as the IPAP set out very, very clearly, And so it's a combination of a wide range of issues, domestic, external shocks, massive global incentives and distortions in the market, and the speed and alacrity and impact that you can bring to bear by government to address market failures are those big ticket issues which members are referring to. So I don't want to engage in a debate with Mr. Huang about precisely why Chinese manufacturing is so successful, and that perhaps could be the subject of a separate colloquium, other than to say that it's not accidental that the Chinese decided to have manufacturing-led growth, and that they deployed a wide range of industrial policy instruments to support that growth, and issues of competitiveness and efficiencies are those, but many others which Mr. Huang, Honorable Huang is referring to. Let me just say that we are not adding price premiums for localization. So in other words, if a designated product is way above the price of the imported product, then it is unlikely to be awarded to a local producer. But as perhaps Catherine can also explain, because of the two-stage tender process, there is the possibility for an engagement around these issues of price, subject to the clear legal requirements set out in the PPPFA. And so, unlike other countries, and Brazil would be one of them, we would not add a price premium to cater for local production. That's a debate. Other countries are doing it. We're not doing it. And it's a complicated debate. So as I said, Brazil is doing it. The question of textiles and the fact that some textiles are unavailable locally and therefore can't be used as an input for the manufacture of clothes which are required for production of certain things for the state. And I think we're talking here mostly uniforms and hospital uniforms and so on and so forth. I'm afraid I'm going to have to undertake to get back to you. And our information is suggests the contrary, but maybe Catherine can come in. Sure.
Going to be there. As our guest has alluded to you, the process of designation, before we designate, we make sure that we'll have capacity. And especially for textiles, it was proven that we have 100% capacity to supply. And with textiles, we know that it has been designated from the year 2002. It's just that this hasn't been made a law. It's only with the new regulations that it's now compulsory. Before it was like on a voluntary basis, but we know with National Treasury all their transversal contracts, they are designated, but not everybody is participating on the transversal contract. But now we've made it a law that everyone must buy 100% local content and production on textile. And the instruction notes were only circulated in July, so it's going to take time to see the impact of these changes. But we're hoping that maybe sometime next year we'll see the change, the graph going up.
Thank you. And I think that raises a very important point. If we think that you're going to get an immediate impact of after the deployment of industrial policy instruments, whether it's concessional, industrial financing, procurement, and so on and so forth, I think we make a mistake. And the point that we were making about administered prices is that there's a danger that sharply escalating administered prices will add to the domestic shocks, which will make potentially this graph go down even steeper, if not a cliff. And that's the problem. So what we're looking at is the deployment of industrial policy instruments which are trying to halt deindustrialization, raise competitiveness, and hopefully industrialize. But we're doing that at a time of a massive global shock, as well as these very significant domestic shocks, especially the electricity prices. So we, as the Department of Trade and Industry, and industry in general, we're fighting against very, very strong headwinds. And so, you know, I think that's absolutely clear. And we certainly don't want to be alarmist, but the graphs speak for themselves, quite frankly. So that would be the one thing. I do apologize, there's a typo mistake. It's the competitive supply development program, not the customized sector development program. I apologize for that. Now, there's a typo. It's referred to as customized, and in fact it should be competitive.
Page six.
That's page six, yes. Supplier development program. I beg your pardon. That falls under the Department of Public Enterprises. I understand, Madam Chair, that they are appearing before this committee, and they can talk in a lot more detail on their precise power and function. We work very closely with them, Tapiwa in particular, in relation to the customized supplier development programs for Transnet and for Eskom and hopefully for other state-owned companies going forward. I think what's quite important is that designation trumps the CSDP. So an SSC cannot ignore a designation. But a customized sector development, a competitive supplier development program is a complicated process which involves difficult negotiations with an original equipment manufacturer. So that would apply, for example, to the fleet procurement for locomotives. So an original equipment supplier would be a General Electric or a Chinese company that has won the other contract to supply locomotives. So in a competitive supplier development program, the procuring entity, Eskom or Transnet, enters into a negotiation with the original equipment supplier, which says, in the first 10 locomotives, can you meet X local content? But in the next 10, can you ramp up your local content to Y percentage? And that then involves very difficult processes, because the component manufacturers to the original equipment manufacturer have to meet the standards and the pricing and the quality specifications of that original equipment manufacturer for the locally produced components, as you are at the same time increasing the local content to meet standards and get higher up the value chain. So it's one thing to make the drivetrains and the bogies and the basic metal of rolling stock. It's another thing to begin to make high technology, knowledge intensive components for a locomotive. And that involves a complicated process of supplier development to identify local manufacturers who can produce it, who can ramp up their capacity to produce higher value products, higher value added products to the right technical specifications, which requires a complicated process and the deployment of other instruments to ramp up competitiveness. So if company X can produce the gears for a locomotive but doesn't have sufficient capacity, can you deploy a matching grant finance to match their investment to enable them to ramp up their capacity to produce those components to technical specifications and requirements of the original equipment manufacturer? I've put it in an example form, madam, because it's a difficult process involved, and Tapiwa could possibly add to what I've said. With respect to the Chinese being awarded Honorable Kwabasa the contract for the supply of locomotives, I would imagine that when DTE comes, you would have to ask the question on the detail. As far as we are concerned, the competitive supply development program will be applied. There will be thresholds for local components, and that those will be ramped up in terms of investment, in terms of developing the local supply base and components. We don't yet have the detail, and in any case, that question should rightfully be answered by the Department of Public Enterprises. With respect to autos, we've done some research on this question. We are convinced that autos should be designated for local procurement, and that's principally because, and Catherine would add here, is that many of the components across original equipment manufacturers are locally made. I speak under correction, but you're talking something like the Polar Cross, I think it has 60% local content, through to other models which have lower local components. I think the thrust of the approach across auto equipment manufacturers is to increase local content, to increase the capacity of local component manufacturers to provide local content into a wide range of autos, and to include the manufacture of medium heavy commercial vehicles into the APDP, including the only South African original equipment manufacturer, which is Bell, that makes medium heavy transport, mining and other equipment. I suppose never say never would apply here, but our understanding for the moment, subject to the correction, of course, of the Minister, is that we would be unlikely to designate autos for local procurement. Madam Chair, the last remaining question, I think, is the issue of whether or not we should apply a premium to procurement. Brazil does it, some other countries do it. We don't do it. I think that's an important economic debate that in a sense falls outside of our functions as public servants. I think we would take a lead if it's given. At the moment we have very clear instructions that premiums don't apply. And that is enshrined in the process that's set out for us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Strachan. I must say I was still not too clear on the Chinese tender really was at the locomotives you raised, Honourable Kielbasa, because it didn't, that question may have to be put to a question in writing, because we're not sure when the local content is kicking in. I know you spoke about it could be making the gears, but are we making it here and sending it across? Because it sounded like they were assembling these locomotives in China. So any local content, you know, we'd have to go by ship or something. I think we need just a clarification on the Honourable Kielbasa, and perhaps we can get the Secretary to put a question to the relevant authority in that regard, and we'll get it then. But the other question which...
Madam Chair, my understanding is that you have invited public enterprises, and so...
We'd like to put it in writing to them so they come prepared for the response, you see. All right. Just on these economic, these graphs, et cetera, you see, if you could just tell me what domestic shock or external shock we had later, because I was trying to backdate some of the graph, take it back from 11, you know, where this, the down started in 2004, as it were. That's 8 years ago. You see what I'm getting? And I'm trying to pinpoint the shock we had then. You know, or is this due to something else, you know? Because was there any energy shock then? Was there, you know, did subprime start then? I'm not really aware of that. So for us, as we go forward, we need to say, when we say domestic and external shocks, global shocks, we can't simply say that without being able to identify the shock in question. So you can come back to us with that, you know, so you needn't answer it now. And then, you know, if that's not a shock entirely, but it is the ratio to the GDP, you know, there could be a number of factors, which I think you did indicate it may not only be the shocks, but a combination. If that could just be made clearer to us, because there's just, you know, some of them stopped going down at 2003, you see. And I think if we get an understanding, what happened then? And that was exacerbated along the line for the next 6 or 7 years. I think that's going to be very helpful to us. We are aware that we, you know, the IPAPs, et cetera, had to undergo a radical transformation and improvement, and with the designations being the last, and that instrument may be the one that brings us back on track. So I think if you could put just synergize that response for us, it's going to be particularly helpful. One of the other things was the price benchmarking. If you could flesh that out, you spoke about that in relation to local manufacturing, production, etc. We could just get that out a little bit more. You then also made a brief reference to local content, etc., and if the mines themselves, the Chamber of Mines, could come to the party, persuade their membership to look at this differently. That we used to produce a lot of mining equipment locally, and so we must have been able to produce the steel or whatever it was at that point. And then you also spoke of, I think, private hospitals, and that too, you know, and of course the private hospitals, it's not simply a matter of DTI per se, but one would imagine even the Minister of Health may be able to work in that regard itself. And having said that, you know, the... It's difficult, certainly for me, perhaps not for other members, when one is talking of the bid evaluations, the invitations, conditions of contract, the award itself. There seems to be out, I don't know, at large, in, you know, the private sector, civil unions, etc., there seems to be an uncertainty about this area. What does it mean? How will it impact? And I think the DDI needs to do even more than they're doing, although in fact I'm aware that the Minister, the DD and the DDGs are going out and doing these road shows, media shows, etc. But as you heard yourself recently, people still remain a little confused about the impact. And we would certainly like them to be moving forward solidly in this particular area. The last point is with respect to the this one here on, I think, slide 14. Government retains the right to under-designate. Undesignate. Fill us in a little bit more there. Honourable Mabasa?
Another one was, is manufacturing is experiencing these challenges that have been articulated, the deteriorating global economic environment, administered pricing, the high wage costs and rigid labor regimes, the cheap imports from other markets, and the skills shortage. In summary, these manufacturing shortcomings, given these manufacturing shortcomings, surely South Africa does have some opportunities and strengths in this sector. What are our comparative advantages, and how can we convert these to variable economic activities and jobs?
Thank you very much. Over to yourself.
Madam Chair, with respect to the graphs, in particular that one, 2004, apart from everything that the Honourable Mabaso has mentioned, the recession, the administered prices, and so on and so forth, the one that we mustn't forget is the value and the volatility of the currency. And that is more or less 2004. So you've got multiple shocks and the interfacing and interlocking of a very serious set of very big problems, which Honourable Mabaso has outlined, although that value and volatility of the currency, and again, you get into economic theory and debate, is perhaps the most important one. And you have to then say, what is the deployment of your policy instruments in relation to this? The first one was the 6 billion rand distress fund from the IDC, and then only by 2008, you have the first IPAP, and frankly speaking, I think only by 2010 do you have the deployment of some other instruments, and only by 2011 and 2012 do you have big ticket support measures kicking in the form of the Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program, which in fact is only been active for the last 4 months. And so combination of these enormous problems and efforts by the state to address the shocks and the market failures together make up a very difficult mix, which includes timing, quantum of the deployment of these instruments, and alarming additional problems which would refer to especially sharply escalating electricity prices, which could contribute to a further decline in exports and lack of competitiveness, closing down of companies and further job losses, given the fact that what we haven't put on as a graph, but which we previously put on, is a sharp decline in employment, 250,000 approximately of which job losses are in the manufacturing sector. So the manufacturing sector bears the brunt of the problem. The price benchmarking, Madam Chair, is price benchmarking globally. So we can't do price benchmarking for every country in the world, but we can take a basket of prices and then ensure that we are not by default paying price premiums which would be applied in other countries. And so that price benchmarking of reference pricing is also applied not only in tender processes, but it would also be applied, for example, by customs. And you heard in previous presentations where we spoke about reference pricing for customs. So it's an invoice bill of lading has a price of X on it, but the reference pricing system of a basket of currencies tells you that in fact the landed price for a product shouldn't be X, it should be Y, then you identify that there's a problem. Madam Chair, the undesignated issue is, I don't think you can designate from now for time immemorial. When you reach a point where companies have become globally competitive, they've got sufficient capacity, aggregate demand has increased, these companies are now don't require support, your policy instruments have been deployed. Industrial policy experience all over the world shows that you reach a point where you have addressed the market failures and you can remove those support instruments. But it also applies to a situation where we have to avoid moral hazard. So we say we are supporting local manufacturers, but if local manufacturers are involved in collusive, anti-competitive behavior, for example, would be one reason where the minister would apply his mind to the possibilities of removing designation. The bid evaluation process, I'm not sure that I understand the question. Maybe Catherine could help.
Okay, under the procurement process, what we're saying is that for procuring entities, when they issue up their bids, they should put as a bid condition the minimum threshold of local content to be achieved for that particular tender during bid invitation. And then for suppliers, we have put documents in place for them to declare their local content, like, for example, the SBD 3.2, that's the specific form wherein they're supposed to declare their local content, and also we have the annexures that they are supposed to use for the calculation of the local content. All these documents, they are supposed to put them in their bid document when they are responding to a tender with designated sector. And then during evaluation, we say a two-stage evaluation process should apply. The first stage, the procurement practitioners, they should look at the local content required, meaning that before they can look at the BEE and price, because we know that tenders are awarded on total points. Before they can start allocating points, they should look at the local content. For those that are not reaching the minimum local content required, they should be qualified during the first stage. Only those that meet the minimum threshold should proceed to the next stage, wherein they will look at BEE and price. In fact, with this nation, we're not changing how they've been doing things. We're only adding to that to say to them that first stage, look at the minimum local content, and then you can proceed to look at BEE and price and allocate points to that and award. And we're going to monitor this process. We have appointed SABS as our local content verification agency, and in the instruction note, we say after award, the procuring entities should inform GTI about the successful bidders. So we'll be having their documents for monitoring purposes. We'll do spot checks. We'll go visit these companies to see to it that whatever they are claiming in their bid document is what's happening at the grassroots level. So that's what is going to happen in the procurement process.
Thank you very much there to the whole team. That's yourself, Acting EDG, Mr. Strachan, Ms. Matiza, Director Fleet Procurement, and Mr. Tapiwa Samanya. Thank you very much for contributing as a team to our understanding of this. But also thank you to Mr. Zakoda the DDD, Empowerment and Enterprise Division, for remaining here so that you become aware of some of our concerns in this respect and the alignment with the proposed amendments in 4BEE has been useful. To the committee who are still sitting here, it is very rare that we finish this much earlier, as it were. Now that's got to show some element of efficiency has been assimilated by everyone. But it was great help. But we would like to thank everyone present here. We've done the minutes, we've done the announcements, and there is a meeting on the 16th, and because unfortunately Solda can't come on the 14th. On the 16th they can't come on the 14th. So it's not because we want to have Friday again, but probably the whip who will be chairing may take some minutes through to Wednesday, and that kind of thing. And you may begin to get a some form of document on the IPAP coming up, some kind of draft on what there is. But I wouldn't like to preempt some of the arrangements that will be pursued in that regard. Suffice to say, as you know, I will be in Europe as part of the ITA-EU focus group there, and we certainly will be once again taking up the key issues wherein Parliament can play a role to re-emphasise the position that we all share with respect to trade and the industrialisation of our country and good governance. So I know that you will welcome the WIPS chairing. He seems to go a lot faster than I do, so you should have a very good week in my absence. Thank you very much to all of you, and thank you to DTI as well. I thank you. The meeting is adjourned.